who are doing this work, rising early in times of difficulty and ease. The meeting ended on the evening of Saturday, 8/20/1988, the secretary noted. Work of Al-Qaeda commenced on 9/10/1988 with a group of 15 brothers. At the bottom of the page, the secretary added, until the date 9/20, Commandant Abu Abeda arrived to inform me of the existence of 30 brothers in Al-Qaeda, meeting the requirements, and thank God. Bin Laden attached no special meaning to the name of the new group. Brother Abu Abeda al-Banshiri, God rest his soul, formed a camp to train youth to fight against the oppressive atheist and truly terrorist Soviet Union, he later stated. We called that place Al-Qaeda in the sense that it was a training base, and that is where the name came from. Bin Laden's associates had mixed reactions to the formation of Al-Qaeda. Abu Rida al-Suri, the Mujahid from Kansas City, claims that when he first heard about the International Arab Legion that bin Laden was creating, he asked doubtfully how many had joined. 60, bin Laden lied. How are you going to transport them? Abu Rida asked. Air France? The formation of Al-Qaeda gave the Arab Afghans something else to fight over. Every enterprise that arose in the sparsely populated cultural landscape was contested, and any head that rose above the crowd was a target. The ongoing jihad in Afghanistan became an afterthought in the war of words and ideas that was being fought in the mosques. Even the Venerable Services Bureau, which bin Laden and his Zom had established to assist the Arabs in their desire to join the jihad, was slandered as a CIA front, and Azam as an American stooge. At the root of these quarrels was the usual culprit, money. Peshawar was the funnel through which cash poured into the jihad and the vast relief effort to help the refugees. The main pool of funds, the hundreds of millions of dollars from the United States and Saudi Arabia, doled out by the Pakistani Inter-Services Intelligence, ISI, each year to the Afghan warlords, was drying up as the Soviets prepared to leave. Scarcity only fed the frenzy over what remained, the international aid agencies, private charities, and bin Laden's pockets. From the beginning, the Egyptians who were sponsoring bin Laden saw Azam as a formidable obstacle. No one among the Arabs enjoyed equal prestige. Most of the young men who had gravitated to jihad were responding to his fatwa, and they regarded Azam with awe. He was an angel, worshipping all night, crying and fasting, recalled his former assistant, Abdullah Anas, who married Azam's daughter just to be close to his mentor. For most of the Arabs who passed through Peshawar, Azam was the most famous man they had ever met. Many of them, including bin Laden, had spent their first nights in Peshawar sleeping on his floor. They spoke movingly of his wisdom, generosity, and courage. He had come to personify the noble spirit of the Arab Afghans, and his shadow reached around the world. Destroying such a celebrated icon would be a treacherous task. The Egyptians were not the only ones interested in bringing down Azam. The Saudis worried that the charismatic leader would convert their young jihadis to the Muslim Brothers. They wanted an independent body, one that was run by a Saudi, that could be entrusted to manage the affairs of the Mujahideen while keeping the kingdom's interests in mind. Bin Laden and Al-Qaeda were seen as a proper Salafist alternative managed by a loyal son of the Saudi regime. Abdullah Anas, the greatest exemplar of the Arab-Afghan warriors, had just returned to Peshawar after fighting beside Ahmad Shah Massoud in northern Afghanistan. He was astounded to learn that there was to be a meeting among the Arab leaders to replace his father-in-law, Abdullah Azam. When Anas talked to him about it, Azam assured him that the election was strictly cosmetic. The Saudi authorities are not pleased that I am leading the Arabs in Afghanistan, Azam explained. All the money that comes for orphans and widows and schools comes from Saudi Arabia. They are unhappy to see the young Saudis being organized under my leadership. They fear they will become a part of the Muslim Brotherhood. The Saudis wanted one of their own in charge. With Osama bin Laden as the new emir, Azam continued, the Saudis would feel safe. They will relax because when they feel Osama is out of control, they can stop him. But I am a Palestinian. They have no way of stopping me. It was even more difficult for Azam to persuade his old friend Sheikh Tamim to support this proposal. Although Azam had told him the election was only a charade to gain Saudi approval, it was clear that others in the meeting had a different agenda. They heatedly used the occasion to slander Azam's reputation with charges of theft and corruption and mismanagement of the services bureau. Sheikh Tamim was outraged and turned to bin Laden. "Say something," he demanded. "I'm the emir of this meeting," bin Laden responded. "Wait for your round." "Who told you that you are my emir?" Tamim began weeping. "Sheikh Abdullah persuaded me to support you, but how do you let these people say these things?" Tamim refused to endorse the vote, which overwhelmingly selected bin Laden as the Arabs' new leader. Azam was philosophical and apparently unconcerned. "Osama is limited," he reassured his supporters. "What can Osama do to organize people? Nobody knows him. Don't worry." Azam was more weakened than he realized. One of Zawahiri's men, Abu Abdulrahman, a Canadian citizen of Egyptian origin, lodged a complaint against Azam. Abu Abdulrahman headed a medical and educational project in Afghanistan. He alleged that Azam's men had snatched the project out of his hands by confiscating the funds that were earmarked for it. He further accused Azam of spreading rumors that he was trying to sell the humanitarian project to the American embassy or a Christian organization. The charges created a sensation in Peshawar. Placards were handed out and posters pasted on the walls demanding that Azam be brought to trial. Fights broke out in the mosques among the different camps of supporters. Behind the charges being thrown at Azam were the Takfiri doctors at the Kuwaiti Red Crescent Hospital, Zawahiri and his colleagues. They had already managed to expel him from the leadership of the hospital's mosque, and now they were gleefully predicting his downfall. "Soon we will see the hand of Abdullah Azam cut off in Peshawar," Dr. Ahmed El-Wed, the Algerian, exclaimed in a meeting. They formed a court to hear the charges, with Dr. Fadl acting as the prosecutor and the judge. This Takfiri court had sat before to consider another mujahid whom they judged guilty of being an apostate. His body was found chopped to pieces inside a burlap bag on a street in Peshawar. On the second day of the trial, after midnight, bin Laden rushed out to fetch his closest Saudi friend, Wael Julidan, who was in bed with chills and a high fever, suffering from malaria. Bin Laden insisted that Julidan come at once. "We cannot trust the Egyptians," he declared. "I swear by God, those people, if they have the chance to make a resolution against Dr. Abdullah Azam, they will kill him." Julidan followed bin Laden back to the meeting, which lasted another couple of hours. The judges found against Azam and ordered the charity returned to Abu Abdulrahman's control. But thanks to bin Laden's intervention, they spared Azam the disgrace of public mutilation. From the perspective of Azam's enemies, however, it was an inconclusive verdict, since it allowed Azam to remain as a figurehead, and they were determined to finish him off. General Boris V. Gromov, the commander of Soviet forces in Afghanistan, walked across the Friendship Bridge into Uzbekistan on February 15, 1989. "There is not a single Soviet soldier or officer left behind me," the general remarked. "Our 9-year stay ends with this." The Soviets had lost 15,000 lives and suffered more than 30,000 casualties. Between 1 million and 2 million Afghans perished, perhaps 90% of them civilians. Villages were razed, crops and livestock destroyed, the landscape studded with mines. A third of the population sheltered in refugee camps in Pakistan or Iran. The Afghan communist government remained in Kabul, however, and the jihad entered a confusing new period. The end of the occupation coincided with a sudden and surprising influx of Arab mujahideen, including hundreds of Saudis who were eager to chase the retreating Soviet bear. According to Pakistan government statistics, more than 6,000 Arabs came to take part in the jihad from 1987 to 1993, twice the number who came for the war against the Soviet occupation. These young men were different from the small cadre of believers who had been lured to Afghanistan by Abdullah Azzam. They were men with large amounts of money and boiling emotions, an Al-Qaeda diarist noted. Pampered kids from the Persian Gulf came on excursions, staying in air-conditioned cargo containers. They were supplied with RPGs and Kalashnikovs, which they could fire into the air, and then they could return home, boasting of their adventure. Many of them were newly religious high school or university students with no history and no one to vouch for them. Chaos and barbarism, which always threatened to overwhelm the movement, sharply increased as bin Laden took the helm. Bank robberies and murders became even more commonplace, justified by absurd religious claims. A group of Takfiris even held up a truck from an Islamic aid agency, absolving their action by saying that the Saudis were infidels. Now that he was the emir of the Arabs, bin Laden held himself above the riotous competition for recruits among the rival Islamic groups that were elbowing each other at the airport as they hustled the newcomers onto their buses. The wrangling was especially nasty among the Egyptians. The two main Egyptian organizations, the Islamic group led by Sheikh Omar Abdul Rahman and Zawahiri's al-Jihad, set up competing guest houses, and they began publishing magazines and broadsides with little purpose other than to vilify each other. Among the accusations made by the Islamic group against Zawahiri were that he had sold arms for gold, which he deposited in a Swiss bank account, and that he was an agent for the Americans, the universal charge of treason. In turn, Zawahiri wrote a tract attacking Sheikh Omar, titled The Blind Leader, in which he recapitulated their prison quarrels for control of the radical Islamist movement. The unstated cause of these slanderous salvos was the question of who was going to control bin Laden, the golden Saudi goose. Bin Laden made his preference known by awarding $100,000 to al-Jihad to begin his operations. Meantime, a new battle was taking shape in Jalalabad, the strategic entry point on the Afghan side of the Khyber Pass, where all the roads and valleys and footpaths converged. The adversary was no longer the Soviet superpower. Now it was the communist Afghan government, which refused to collapse as so many had predicted. One of the ugly ironies of the Arab-Afghan crusade is that it was made up by a large majority of Muslims who came to fight Muslims, not Soviet invaders. The siege of Jalalabad was supposed to close the curtain on communist rule in Afghanistan. Emboldened by the Soviet withdrawal, the Mujahideen had contemptuously decided to mount a frontal assault on the Afghan position. The city, which stood behind a river in a wide corridor of Russian mines, was defended by thousands of Afghan government troops, who were demoralized by the articles in the Pakistani press of the impending Mujahideen attack and the inevitable rapid victory that was supposed to follow. The initial assault came in March 1989, with 5,000 to 7,000 Afghan Mujahideen charging down Highway 1. Eight different commanders led them in, not counting the Arabs who followed bin Laden. After overrunning the airport on the outskirts of town, the Mujahideen fell back against a powerful counterattack. Then matters settled into an unexpected stalemate, with the various Mujahideen commanders involved in the siege refusing to coordinate with one another. Bin Laden and his military staff occupied a small cave in the mountains, 4 kilometers above the city. He had fewer than 200 men under his command. Once again, he was ill. His biographer, Issam Daraz, arrived, bringing with him a supply of vitamins and 12 boxes of Arkalian, a drug bin Laden always requested. He told Daraz that it was to help with his concentration. Arkalian is normally prescribed for a marked decrease in muscle strength or stamina, which might be caused by vitamin deficiencies or lead poisoning, among other things. Bin Laden's health, which had been so robust when he was a desert youth, had endured several blows in the harsh mountain environs. Like many of the men, He had contracted malaria. Then, in the severe winter of 1988-89, he nearly died of pneumonia when an intense snowfall buried him and several companions in their vehicle for a few days. The prolonged and unanticipated siege of Jalalabad taxed his weakened constitution further, and he was nagged increasingly by puzzling spells of back pain and paralyzing fatigue. Zawafri, who had developed a reputation among the Arab fighters as being a medical genius, drove over from Peshawar two or three times a week to treat the injured. His main patient, of course, was bin Laden, who needed intravenous glucose treatments to keep from fainting. Bin Laden would lie for hours on the floor of the cave, in pain and unable to move. The diagnosis was low blood pressure, which is usually a symptom of another ailment. Whatever bin Laden's health problems were, the friendship between him and Zawafri would always be complicated by the fact that one placed his life in the hands of the other. Afghan bombers flew 20 sorties a day, pummeling the Mujahideen infantry with cluster bombs. Bin Laden and his men were dug into a trench between two mountain positions. On one occasion, bin Laden was awaiting a glucose transfusion from Zawafri, who set up a metal pole to hold the bottle and then inserted the IV tube into the bottle. Bin Laden rolled up his sleeve and waited for his doctor to slip the cannula into his vein. Just then, a bomber roared overhead at a low altitude, followed by explosions that shook the mountains. Smoke and dust blanketed the Mujahideen, who crept out of the trench to see what had been hit. As it turned out, the bombs had fallen on the peak above them, but the hail of rocks had knocked over the glucose stand. Zawafri calmly set the stand back up and untangled the IV tube. He got another sterile cannula, but once again, just as bin Laden stretched out his arm, a series of explosions pelted the men with rocks and blasted the wooden beam supporting the walls of the trench. The bombs were right on top of them. The men hugged the earth and waited until the aircraft disappeared. Then Zawafri collected the stand and the same glucose bottle, which this time had been hurled across the trench. By now, the men had become fixated on the bottle, as if it were a living entity with a secret, Duraz recalled. One of the men complained to Zawafri, "Don't you see? Every time you put that bottle on the stand, we are bombed." Zawafri laughed and refused to switch to another glucose bottle. "It's merely a coincidence," he said. But as he prepared to insert the needle, yet another terrifying series of explosions shattered the landscape and sent the men diving to the ground, crying out in mumbling verses from the Quran. The timbers holding the roof were blown apart, and the trench was open to the sky. Then came a cry that they were being attacked with poison gas. They quickly put on their gas masks. In the midst of the smoke and fear and confusion, Zawafri patiently reassembled the metal stand, and again he picked up the glucose container. Everyone in the trench began to shout at him, "Throw the bottle outside! Don't touch it!" Bin Laden tried to remind them that evil omens are forbidden in Islam, but as Zawafri started to attach the IV tube, one of the Saudis stood up and wordlessly took the glucose bottle out of Zawafri's hands and hurled it out of the trench. Everyone laughed, even bin Laden, but they were all happy to see the bottle gone. There was a young man fighting beside bin Laden during the siege of Jalalabad named Shafiq. Less than 5 feet tall, weighing perhaps 90 pounds, he was one of the few original Saudis who remained loyal, despite the Egyptian entourage that encircled his leader. Jamal Khalifa, who was his teacher in Medina, remembered Shafiq as a polite, neatly groomed young man who had dropped out of school when he was 16 to join the jihad. His father had soon come to Afghanistan to fetch him home. Khalifa was shocked when he saw his former student once again in Saudi Arabia. His hair was matted and hanging over his shoulders, and he wore dirty shoes and Afghan pants. The schoolboy had been completely transformed into a toughened warrior who couldn't wait to return to battle. Only a few weeks had passed before Shafiq snatched his passport from where his father had hidden it and returned to the war, a decision that had historic consequences. One day, a sentry in Jalalabad noticed Afghan army helicopters bearing down on the Arab position, followed by tanks and infantry. They were being led by a traitorous mujahid who had sold them out. The sentry called to bin Laden's men to evacuate the cave where they were hunkered down, but by that time the armored units were upon them, ready to annihilate the entire outpost. Bin Laden hurried away with the rest of his soldiers except for Shafiq, who single-handedly covered their retreat with a small mortar. Without the few moments of relief that Shafiq provided, bin Laden would likely have died in Jalalabad, along with his unrealized dream. 80 other Arabs did die there, including Shafiq, in the greatest disaster of the Arab-Afghan experience. Al-Qaeda held its first recruitment meeting in the Farouk camp near Khost, Afghanistan, shortly after the debacle in Jalalabad. Farouk was a takfir camp, established by Zawahiri and Dr. Fadl, devoted entirely to training the elite Arab mujahideen being groomed to join bin Laden's private army. Although the lion's den was just across the mountain, the Farouk camp was kept isolated from the others so that the young men could be closely watched. Those chosen were young, zealous, and obedient. They were given a bonus and were told to bid farewell to their families. The majority of the leadership council set up to advise bin Laden were Egyptians, including Zawahiri, Abu Hafs, Abu Abeda, and Dr. Fadl. Also represented were members from Algeria, Libya, and Oman. The organization opened an office in a two-story villa in Hyderabad, the suburb of Peshawar, where most of the Arabs resided. New recruits filled out forms in triplicate, signed their oath of loyalty to bin Laden, and swore themselves to secrecy. In return, single members earned about $1,000 a month in salary. Married members received $1,500. Everyone got a round-trip ticket home each year and a month of vacation. There was a health care plan, and for those who changed their mind, a buyout option. They received $2,400 and went on their way. From the beginning, Al-Qaeda presented itself as an attractive employment opportunity for men whose education and careers had been curtailed by jihad. The leaders of Al-Qaeda developed a constitution and bylaws, which described the utopian goals of the organization in clear terms: to establish the truth, get rid of evil, and establish an Islamic nation. This would be accomplished through education and military training, as well as coordinating and supporting jihad movements around the world. The group would be led by a commander who was impartial, resolute, trustworthy, patient, and just. He should have at least 7 years of jihad experience, and preferably a college degree. Among his duties were appointing a council of advisors to meet each month, establishing a budget, and deciding on a yearly plan of action. One can appreciate the ambition of Al-Qaeda by looking at its bureaucratic structure, which included committees devoted to military affairs, politics, information, administration, security, and surveillance. The military committee had subsections dedicated to training, operations, research, and nuclear weapons. After the failure of Jalalabad, the Afghan mujahideen succumbed to a cataclysmic civil war. The strongest parties in this fratricide were Gulbuddin Hekmatyar and Ahmad Shah Massoud. Both were ruthless, charismatic leaders from the north, bent on establishing an Islamic government in Afghanistan. Hekmatyar, the more skilled politician, was a Pashtun, the dominant tribe in both Pakistan and Afghanistan. He had the backing of the Pakistan ISI, and therefore of the United States and Saudi Arabia. Massoud, one of the most talented guerrilla leaders of the 20th century, was Tajik, from the Persian-speaking tribe that is the second largest ethnic group in Afghanistan. Based in the Panjshir Valley north of Kabul, Massoud rarely traveled to Peshawar, the hotbed of intelligence agencies and international media. Most of the Arabs sided with Hekmatyar, excepting Abdullah Anas, the son-in-law of Abdullah Azam. Anas talked the sheikh into visiting Massoud to see for himself what kind of man he was. The trip to visit the Lion of Panjshir required 8 days of walking across 4 peaks in the Hindu Kush Mountains. As they hiked through the mountains, Azam reflected on the Jalalabad fiasco. He worried that the Afghan jihad had been a disorganized, misguided failure. The Soviets were gone and now the Muslims were fighting each other. Massoud and a guard of 100 men met them on the Pakistan border and led them down into the Panjshir Valley. Massoud lived in a cave with 2 bedrooms, like a gypsy, said Anas, who translated for the 2 men. Azam was charmed by Massoud's modesty and admired the discipline of his troops, which stood in such contrast to the other Mujahideen irregular forces. "We are your soldiers," Azam pledged. "We love you, and we are going to help you." When he returned to Peshawar, Azam made no secret of his revised opinion of Massoud. He even traveled to Saudi Arabia and Kuwait, saying, "I have seen the true Islamic Jihad. It is Massoud." Hekmatyar was enraged by Azam's turnaround, which could cost him the support of his Arab backers. Azam had already accumulated many enemies with dark hearts and bloody hands. Bin Laden begged Azam to stay away from Peshawar, which had become too dangerous for his former mentor. One Friday, Hekmatyar's men discovered and disarmed a powerful bomb in the mosque near Azam's house. It was an anti-tank mine planted under the rostrum that Azam stood upon when he led prayers. Had it exploded, hundreds of worshippers could have been killed. Confused and despondent because of the civil war among the Mujahideen, and still suffering from the embarrassment of Jalalabad, Bin Laden returned to Saudi Arabia for consultations with Saudi intelligence. He wanted to know which side to fight on. Prince Turkey's chief of staff, Ahmed Badib, told him, "It's better to leave." Before he quit Peshawar entirely, Bin Laden returned to say farewell to Azam. Bin Laden's rise had left Azam vulnerable, but somehow their friendship had survived. They embraced for a long time, and both men shed many tears, as if they knew that they would never see each other again. On November 24, 1989, Azam rode to the mosque with 2 of his sons, Ibrahim and Muhammad, who was the driver. As Muhammad was parking, a roadside bomb made from 20 kilograms of TNT exploded with such force that the car shattered. Body parts were strewn over the trees and power lines. A leg of one of his children flew through a shop window 100 yards away. But Azam's body, it is said, was found peacefully resting against a wall, completely intact, not at all disfigured. Earlier that Friday, on the streets of Peshawar, Azam's main rival, Ayman al-Zawahiri, had been spreading rumors that Azam was working for the Americans. The next day, he was at Azam's funeral, praising the martyred sheikh, as did his many other jubilant enemies. Chapter 7 Return of the Hero. Fame creates its own authority, even in Saudi Arabia, where humility is prized and prestige is carefully pruned among non-royals. It is a country that forbids the public display of portraits, except for the faces of the omnipresent ruling princes, who also name the streets and hospitals and universities after themselves, hoarding whatever glory is available. So, when Bin Laden returned to his hometown of Jeddah in the fall of 1989, he presented a dilemma that was unique in modern Saudi history. Only 31 years old, he commanded an international volunteer army of unknown dimensions. Because he actually believed the fable, promoted by the Saudi press, that his Arab Legion had brought down the mighty superpower, he arrived with certain unprecedented expectations of his future. He was better known than all but a few princes in the upper tier of Wahhabi clergy, the kingdom's first real celebrity. He was rich, although not by royal standards or even those of the great merchant families of the Hejaz. His share of the Saudi Bin Laden group at the time amounted to 27 million Saudi rials, a little more than $7 million. He also received a portion of the annual earnings from the company that ranged from $500,000 to ₱1 million a year. He settled back into the family business, helping to build roads in Taif and Abha. He kept a house in Jeddah and another in Medina, the city he had always loved the most, where he could be close to the Prophet's mosque. The young idealist returned to the kingdom with a sense of divine mission. He had risked death and had been, he thought, miraculously spared. He had gone as an acolyte of an iconic Muslim warrior, and he returned as the undisputed leader of the Arab Afghans. He had a commanding air of confidence, which was all the more seductive because of his instinctive humility. In a time when Saudis were increasingly uncertain about their identity in the modern world, bin Laden appeared as an unsullied archetype. His piety and humble manner reminded Saudis of their historic image of themselves as shy and self-effacing, but also fierce and austere. Some of his young admirers called him the Othman of his age, a reference to one of the early caliphs, a wealthy man known for his righteousness. Inevitably, bin Laden's fame cast an unwelcome light on the behavior of the Saudi royal family, led by King Fahd, who was known for his boozing and carousing in the ports of the French Riviera, where he docked his 482-foot yacht, the $100 million Abdulaziz. The ship featured two swimming pools, a ballroom, a gym, a theater, a portable garden, a hospital with an intensive care unit and two operating rooms, and four American Stinger missiles. The king also liked to fly to London in his $150 million 747 jet, equipped with his own fountain. He lost millions in the casinos on these excursions. One night, upset with the curfew imposed by British gaming laws, he hired his own blackjack and roulette dealer so that he could gamble in his hotel suite all night long. Other Saudi princes enthusiastically followed his example, notably King Fahd's son, Mohammed, who accepted more than $1 billion in bribes according to British court documents, which he spent on whores, pornography, fleets of more than 100 high-performance cars, palaces in Cannes and Geneva, and such luxuries as powerboats, chartered jets, ski chalets, and jewelry. Oil prices collapsed in the mid-1980s, sending the Saudi economy into a deficit, but the royal family continued taking massive personal loans from the country's banks, which they rarely repaid. Every substantial business deal required commissions, kickbacks, to the royal mafia to lubricate the agreement. Individual princes confiscated land and muscled in on private businesses. This was in addition to the secret but substantial monthly allowance that each member of the family received. Al Saud became a byword for corruption, hypocrisy, and insatiable greed. The attack on the Grand Mosque 10 years before, however, had awakened the royal family to the lively prospect of revolution. The lesson the family drew from that gory standoff was that it could protect itself against religious extremists only by empowering them. Consequently, the Matawa, government-subsidized religious vigilantes, became an overwhelming presence in the kingdom, roaming through the shopping malls and restaurants, chasing men into the mosque at prayer time, and ensuring that women were properly cloaked. Even a strand of hair poking out from under a hijab could rate a flogging with the swagger sticks these men carried. In their quest to stamp out sinfulness and heresy, they even broke into private homes and businesses, and they waged war on the proliferating satellite dishes, often shooting at them with government-issued weapons from government-issued Chevrolet Suburbans. Officially known as representatives of the Committee for the Promotion of Virtue and the Prevention of Vice, the Matawa would become the models for the Taliban in Afghanistan. Prince Turki presented a striking contrast to the public image of the royal family. Courteous, charming, and soft-spoken, he was the kind of man many people knew and liked. But he was also guarded and private, and he kept the various parts of his life so carefully separated that no one knew him well. He enjoyed the royal prerogatives of power, but within the kingdom he lived in an appealingly humble manner. He occupied a comparatively modest one-story house in Riyadh with his wife, Princess Nuf, and their six children, and on weekends he retreated to his desert ranch, where he raised ostriches. He wore the invariable Saudi garments, the ankle-length white gown called a thobe, and a red-checked headscarf. The fundamentalists respected him because he was an Islamic scholar, but he was also an advocate of women's rights, so the progressives saw him as a possible champion. He ran an intelligence service in the Middle East, which is usually a watchword for torture and assassination. But he had quickly gained a reputation for valuing clean hands. His father was the martyred king. His beloved mother, Ifat, was the only woman in Saudi history ever called queen. All that, plus his youth and his important career, meant that Turkey would have to be considered when the grandsons of Abdulaziz finally have the opportunity to contend for the crown. Outside the kingdom, Turkey lived a different life. He kept a house in London and an elaborate flat in Paris. He cruised the Mediterranean on his yacht, White Knight. In the drawing rooms of London and New York, he was known to favor the occasional banana daiquiri, but he was not a gambler or a lush. Because he fit comfortably into several different worlds, he had the quality of reflecting the virtues that others longed to see in him. The CIA worked closely with Turkey and his service during the Afghan Jihad, and he had impressed the agency with his insight, the range of his knowledge, and his easy familiarity with American customs. There was an assumption on the part of some members of the U.S. intelligence community that Turkey was our man in Riyadh, but others found him deceitful and reluctant to share information. These reactions mirrored the thorny relationship the Americans and the Saudis found themselves entangled in. One Friday, Turkey went to a mosque in Riyadh, where the imam had spoken out against certain female charitable organizations, including one that was overseen by five members of the Faisal family. Turkey had listened to a tape recording of the sermon in which the imam had called the women running the charity whores. It was an astounding breach of the ancient bargain between al-Sud and the Wahhabi clergy. The following week, Turkey sat in the front row of the mosque, and when the imam rose to speak, Turkey furiously confronted him. "This man has defamed my family," Turkey shouted into the microphone. "My sisters, my daughter-in-law. Either he proves it, or I'm going to sue." A witness to the event says that Turkey actually threatened to kill the man on the spot. The daring slander and Prince Turkey's furious response threw the country into turmoil. The governor of Riyadh, Prince Salman, placed the offending imam under arrest. He quickly offered his apology, which Turkey accepted. But Turkey realized that the balance of power between the two factions had begun to shift. Many of his family members were cowed by the religious posse that roamed the malls and streets with policemen at their command. The super piety of the Matawa was bound to focus itself on the conspicuous depravity of some members of the royal family. Now, however, they had even attacked the charitable works of popular and upstanding princesses who sought to advance women's causes. Clearly, the royal family could not abide such an insult. But the fact that such things were being said in public demonstrated that the Matawa were emboldened enough to preach revolution right under the noses of the ruling princes. Like the CIA, Turkey's intelligence service was not supposed to operate inside the homeland. That was the province of Prince Naif, Turkey's truculent uncle, who ran the interior ministry, and who jealously guarded his territory. Turkey decided that the situation inside the country was too dangerous to be ignored, even if it meant intruding into Naif's domain. He secretly began monitoring members of the Matawa. He learned that many of them were ex-convicts whose only job qualification was that they had memorized the Quran in order to reduce their sentences. but they had become so powerful, Turkey believed, that they now threatened to overthrow the government. Life in Saudi Arabia had always been marked by abstinence, submissiveness, and religious fervor. But the reign of the Mutawa stifled social interaction and imposed a dangerous new orthodoxy. For centuries, the four main schools of Islamic jurisprudence, Hanafi, Maliki, Shafi, and Hanbali, were taught and studied in Mecca. The Wahhabis ostensibly held themselves above such doctrinal divisions, but in practice they ruled out other interpretations of the faith. The government forbade the Shia, who form a substantial minority in Saudi Arabia, from building new mosques or expanding existing ones. Only Wahhabis worship freely. Not content to cleanse its own country of the least degree of religious freedom, the Saudi government set out to evangelize the Islamic world, using the billions of riyals at its disposal through the religious tax, zakat, to construct hundreds of mosques and colleges and thousands of religious schools around the globe, staffed with Wahhabi imams and teachers. Eventually, Saudi Arabia, which constitutes only 1% of the world Muslim population, would support 90% of the expenses of the entire faith, overriding other traditions of Islam. Music disappeared in the kingdom. Shortly after the 1979 attack on the Grand Mosque in Mecca, Kulthum and Fayrouz, the songbirds of the Arab world, were banished from the kingdom's television stations, which were already dominated by bearded men debating fine points of religious law. There had been a few movie theaters in Saudi Arabia before the mosque attack, but they were quickly shut down. A magnificent concert hall was completed in Riyadh in 1989, but it never hosted a single performance. Censorship smothered art and literature, and intellectual life, which had scarcely had the chance to blossom in the young country, withered. Paranoia and fanaticism naturally occupy minds that are closed and fearful. For the young, the future in this already joyless environment promised even less than the present. Only a few years earlier, Saudi Arabia had been on its way to becoming the wealthiest country per capita in the world, thanks to the bounty of its oil wealth. Now the declining price of oil crushed such expectations. The government, which had promised jobs to university graduates, withdrew its guarantees, creating the previously unknown phenomenon of unemployment. Despair and idleness are dangerous companions in any culture, and it was inevitable that the young would search for a hero who could voice their longing for change and provide a focus for their rage. Neither a cleric nor a prince, Osama bin Laden assumed this new role, even though there was no precedent for such an independent agent in the kingdom. He offered a conventional Muslim brother's critique of the plight of the Arab world. The West, particularly the United States, was responsible for the humiliating failure of the Arabs to succeed. "They have attacked our brothers in Palestine as they have attacked Muslims and Arabs elsewhere," he said one spring night in the bin Laden family mosque in Jeddah, just after evening prayers. "The blood of Muslims is shed. It has become too much. We are only looked upon as sheep, and we are very humiliated." Bin Laden wore a white robe with a gauzy camel-colored cloak draped over his shoulders. He spoke in a sleepy monotone, sometimes wagging his long, bony index finger to make a point, but his manner was relaxed and his gestures were limp and wan. Already the messianic stare into the middle distance that would characterize his later pronouncements was on display. Before him, hundreds of men sat cross-legged on the carpet. Many of them had fought with him in Afghanistan, and they sought a new direction in their lives. Their old enemy, the Soviet Union, was falling to pieces, but America did not seem to offer such an obvious substitute. At first, it was difficult to grasp the basis of bin Laden's complaint. The United States had never been a colonial power, nor, for that matter, had Saudi Arabia ever been colonized. Of course, he was speaking for Muslims in general, for whom American support of Israel was a cause of anguish, but the United States had been a decisive ally in the Afghan jihad. The sense of humiliation he expressed had more to do with the stance of Muslims in the modern world. Their lives were sold at a discount, bin Laden was telling his hometown audience, which confirmed their sense that other lives, Western, American lives, were fuller and more worthwhile. Bin Laden gave them a history lesson. America went to Vietnam, thousands of miles away, and began bombing them in planes. The Americans did not get out of Vietnam until after they suffered great losses. Over 60,000 American soldiers were killed until there were demonstrations by the American people. The Americans won't stop their support of Jews in Palestine until we give them a lot of blows. They won't stop until we do jihad against them. There he stood, on the threshold of advocating violence against the United States, but he suddenly stopped himself. What is required is to wage an economic war against America, he continued. We have to boycott all American products. They're taking the money we pay them for their products and giving it to the Jews to kill our brothers. The man who had made his name in combat against the Soviets now invoked Mahatma Gandhi, who brought down the British Empire by boycotting its products and wearing non-Western clothes. He urged a public relations campaign. Any American we see, we should notify of our complaints, bin Laden meekly concluded. We should write to American embassies. Bin Laden would later say that the United States had always been his enemy. He dated his hatred for America to 1982, when America permitted the Israelis to invade Lebanon and the American Sixth Fleet helped them. He recalled the carnage. Blood and severed limbs, women and children sprawled everywhere, houses destroyed along with their occupants and high-rises demolished over their residents. The situation was like a crocodile meeting a helpless child, powerless, except for his screams. This scene provoked an intense desire to fight tyranny, he said, and a longing for revenge. As I looked at those demolished towers in Lebanon, it entered my mind that we should punish the oppressor in kind, and that we should destroy towers in America in order that they taste some of what we tasted. His actions at the time belied this public stance. Privately, bin Laden approached members of the royal family during the Afghan jihad to express his gratitude for American participation in that war. Prince Bandar bin Sultan, the Saudi ambassador to the United States, remembered bin Laden coming to him and saying, thank you for bringing the Americans to help us get rid of the secularist, atheist Soviets. Bin Laden had never shown himself to be an interesting or original political thinker. His analysis until then was standard Islamist boilerplate, uninformed by any deep experiences in the West. And yet, wrapped in the mystique that had been spun around him, bin Laden held a position in Saudi society that gave weight to his pronouncements. The very fact that his American critique was being uttered at all, in a country where speech was so curtailed, suggested to other Saudis that there must be royal consent behind the anti-American campaign that bin Laden had launched. Few countries in the world were so different from each other and yet so dependent on one another as America and Saudi Arabia. Americans built the Saudi petroleum industry. American construction companies such as Bechtel built much of the country's infrastructure. Howard Hughes's company, Trans World Airlines, built the Saudi passenger air service. The Ford Foundation modernized Saudi government. The U.S. Corps of Engineers built the country's television and broadcast facilities and oversaw the development of its defense industry. Meantime, Saudi Arabia sent its top students to American universities, more than 30,000 per year during the 1970s and 1980s. In return, more than 200,000 Americans have lived and worked in the kingdom since the discovery of oil. Saudi Arabia needed American investment, management, technology, and education to guide it into the modern world. America, for its part, became increasingly reliant on Saudi oil to sustain its economic and military supremacy. In 1970, the United States was the 10th greatest importer of Saudi oil. A decade later, it was number one. By that time, Saudi Arabia had replaced Iran as America's main ally in the Persian Gulf. The kingdom depended on U.S. arms and defense agreements for its protection. Thus, the apparent complicity on the part of the royal family in bin Laden's escalating verbal attack on America seemed a suicidal paradox. But so long as bin Laden remained focused on an external enemy, he diverted popular attention from the princely looting of the oil wealth and the spiral of religious fanaticism. Events would soon give bin Laden the excuse he sought to make America into the enemy he needed. In 1989, bin Laden approached Prince Turki with a bold plan. He would use his Arab irregulars to overthrow the Marxist government of South Yemen. Bin Laden was enraged by the communist rule in his ancestral home, and he saw an opportunity to exploit his partnership with the Saudi government to purge the Arabian Peninsula of any secular influences. It would be bin Laden's first opportunity to put al-Qaeda into action. Saudi Arabia had always had an uneasy relationship with its smaller, poorer, and more populous southern neighbors, the Yemenis. The quarreling twins posed a strategic problem as well. Reaching across the southern tip of the Arabian Peninsula, with its thumb on the throat of the Red Sea, South Yemen was the only Marxist entity in the Arab world. North Yemen was a pro-Western military regime, but it was constantly engaged in boundary disputes with the kingdom. Turki listened to bin Laden's offer and declined. "It's a bad idea," he told him. The Saudis had a long history of meddling in the affairs of both Yemens, so Turki's demurral wasn't a matter of propriety. Bin Laden spoke of my mujahideen and of liberating South Yemen from the Kafirs. The grandeur of bin Laden's manner put Turki off. Shortly after the meeting between bin Laden and the Saudi intelligence chief, North and South Yemen came to an unexpected agreement to merge their countries into an entity that would be called the Republic of Yemen. Oil had been discovered in the ill-defined border region between the two impoverished countries, and now there was an incentive to resolve their arguments through politics rather than arms. Bin Laden, however, was not reconciled to peace. He became convinced that the Americans had a secret agreement with the socialists to create a military base in Yemen, and therefore he set out to wreck this alliance by financing a guerrilla war. Soon, Yemeni veterans of the Afghan Jihad began showing up at his apartment house in Jeddah and leaving with suitcases full of cash to supply the rebellion. Ahmed Badi, bin Laden's old teacher, went to pay a call on him, no doubt at Turkey's direction. Bin Laden was managing investments in Jeddah at the time. As they spoke, Badib took the measure of anger in his former student's voice and realized something was going to happen. Bin Laden simply could not tolerate the fact that there were any communists in the coalition government at all. He insisted on imposing his own ill-defined notions of Islamic government in place of the peaceful and practical political solution that the Yemenis had agreed upon. In bin Laden's mind, the entire peninsula was sacred and had to be cleansed of foreign elements. The fact that his father was born in the Hadramaut, in the southern part of the country, fortified his fervent desire to liberate his kinsmen from any vestige of communist rule. He made a number of trips to the new republic, speaking in mosques to incite the opposition. His al-Qaeda brigade worked with tribal leaders in the north to carry out raids in the cities of the south and to assassinate socialist leaders. These murderous forays had an effect. With the brittle Union in danger of breaking apart into civil war once again, the new president of the Republic of Yemen, Ali Abdullah Saleh, traveled to Saudi Arabia to plead with King Fahd to keep bin Laden under control. The king firmly instructed bin Laden to stay out of Yemen's affairs. Bin Laden denied that he was involved, but soon he was back in Yemen, making more speeches and campaigning against the communists. The frustrated and irate Yemeni president returned to Saudi Arabia to press his case once again before King Fahd who was unused to being disobeyed by his subjects, much less openly lied to. He turned to the family enforcer. The Minister of the Interior, Prince Naif, an imperious figure often compared to J. Edgar Hoover, summoned bin Laden to his office. The ministry occupies a strangely unsettling building, an inverted pyramid, that looms on the perimeter of downtown Riyadh. Tubular black elevator columns rise inside the vast and disorienting marble atrium, which seems specially designed to diminish anyone who stands there. Bin Laden had reported to Naif in this building many times during the Afghan jihad, scrupulously keeping the government informed of his activities. He had always received respectful treatment in the past due to his family, his status, and the loyalty to the royal family that he had displayed over the years. This time was different. Naif spoke to him harshly and demanded his passport. The prince didn't want to hear any more about bin Laden's personal foreign policy. It was a cold splash of reality. But bin Laden felt double-crossed. "I was working for the sake of the Saudi government," he complained to his friends. As the richest country in the region, surrounded by envious neighbors, Saudi Arabia was also the most anxious. When King Faisal commissioned the country's first census in 1969, he was so shocked by how small the population actually was that he immediately doubled the figure. Since then, the statistics in the kingdom have been distorted by this fundamental lie. By 1990, Saudi Arabia claimed a population of more than 14 million, nearly equal to that of Iraq, although Prince Turki privately estimated the kingdom's population to be a little over 5 million. Always fearful of being overrun and plundered, the Saudi government spent billions of dollars on weapons, buying the most sophisticated equipment on the market from the United States, Britain, France, and China, and further enriching members of the royal family with lucrative kickbacks. In the 1980s, the kingdom built a $50 billion air defense system. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers moved its foreign headquarters from Germany to Saudi Arabia in order to construct bases, schools, and headquarters complexes for the Saudi Army, Air Force, Navy, and National Guard. After the U.S. Congress passed laws prohibiting American companies from participating in bribery and kickbacks with foreign agents, the Saudi government concluded the largest arms deal in history with Great Britain. By the end of the decade, the kingdom should have been well equipped to defend itself against the immediate threats in its neighborhood. It had the weapons. All it lacked was training and troops. An actual army, in other words. In 1990, bin Laden warned of the danger that the murderous tyrant in Iraq, Saddam Hussein, posed to Saudi Arabia. He was treated as a Cassandra. "I said many times in my speeches at the mosque, warning that Saddam will enter the Gulf," bin Laden lamented. "No one believed me." Much of the Arab world was elated by Saddam's anti-Western rhetoric and his threats to burn half of Israel with chemical weapons. He was especially popular in Saudi Arabia, which maintained cordial relations with its northern neighbor. Nonetheless, bin Laden continued his lonely campaign against Saddam and his secular Ba'ath Party. Once again, the king was annoyed by bin Laden, a dangerous position for any Saudi subject to find himself in. The kingdom had signed a non-aggression pact with Iraq, and Saddam had personally assured Fahd that he had no intention of invading Kuwait, even as he was moving Republican Guard divisions to the border. The Saudi government warned bin Laden once again to mind his own business, then followed up on the threat by sending the National Guard to raid bin Laden's farm and arrest several of his workers. Bin Laden protested this outrage to Crown Prince Abdullah, the commander of the National Guard, who denied knowing about the incident. On July 31st, King Fahd personally chaired a meeting between representatives of Iraq and Kuwait to arbitrate the disputes between the two countries, which concerned the ownership of the invaluable oil fields on the border. Saddam also contended that Kuwait's high rate of production was driving down the price of petroleum and ruining the Iraqi economy, already bankrupted by a disastrous war with Iran that Saddam had provoked in 1980, which ended 8 years later after a million casualties. Despite the king's mediation, talks between Iraq and Kuwait quickly fell apart. 2 days later, the formidable Iraqi army rolled over the tiny nation, and suddenly all that stood between Saddam Hussein and the Saudi oil fields was a few miles of sand, and the superbly